a corporation for public broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, there's a new film out about an incident in the life of former U.S. Senator Ted Kennedy. It's called Chappaquiddick. It looks at how Kennedy handled an incident in which, after a night of drinking, he drove off a bridge in Massachusetts and a passenger in his car was killed. The incident forever overshadowed his desire to run for president. We'll talk about the incident and the film with a friend and biographer of Senator Ted Kennedy in just a moment. But first, three listener comments about yesterday's program. On the program, we had a debate about autonomous vehicles, and we also received a call about our overall coverage of the killing of 64 Palestinian protesters this week at the border between Israel and Gaza. Here's what three listeners had to say.
Rob, this is Howard in Clearwater. I listen to the show most days, but I have to say today's show featuring Senator Brundy's and Mr. Swope debating autonomous vehicles was far better than average. Instead of hearing the opinions of listeners focused on what happened yesterday, as concerned as they may be, it gives all pause to consider what will happen tomorrow and the chance to do something about it. Autonomous vehicles will be here, as they stated. It's not the distant future. Thanks to Mr. Swope for going toe-to-toe professionally with Senator Brundy's. It's quite clear from the senator's statements that he and his political party have already been bought by the auto industry. I can imagine the future cheating a la Volkswagen style, unless the recording systems of autonomous vehicles are tightened better than the black boxes on aircraft. I worked in high-level management in the auto industry for over a decade and can assure you that the executives will spare nothing, not even the lives of their customers, to achieve their bonuses. I'm calling this message in 2 in the evening, but we'll be contacting Mr. Swope tomorrow to find out what we, as the at-risk citizens, can do to prevent the miserable outcomes he predicts. Thanks again for a forward-thinking show.
This is Peter. I sent you an email about level 5 driving with these automated cars, level 1 being a Model T, level 5 being think about where you want to go and the car will take you there with no problems. But anyway, the title of my email was level 5. No more blood alcohol levels? Then I went on to say, will DUIs be a thing of the past? What will our law enforcement and lawyers do? Oh, my. And then I signed off with Peter, Level 2, Indian Shores. Good shows as always, Rob. Thanks.
About the message you had for the last few days about the embassy, U.S. embassy in Israel, I left Israel in March of 2000. When I left, the U.S. consulate and the U.S. embassy, I've been to both, the U.S. consulate has been in Jerusalem ever since I've been there for the longest time. The U.S. embassy being in Tel Aviv, one street across from the beach, they both are under the same umbrella. They both fly the American flag. They both have U.S. Marines. So when people get uproar about the U.S. embassy, sure, they have different functions, absolutely. I don't understand why they also don't get upset when the U.S. consulate that flies the American flag has been there for the longest time in Jerusalem. Again, because it represents our nation. I guess most people are not aware of this. I wish it would be communicated to other people to let them know. If you've got a boycott, you could have done this a long time ago.
Well, there you have three listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. In July of 1969, then U.S. Senator Edward Kennedy and friends and associates had attended a nighttime party on Chappaquiddick Island near Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. At some point during the evening, Kennedy left the party along with a young woman named Mary Jo Kopechne, who had worked for his late brother Robert. Robert had been assassinated the year before. Ted Kennedy drove his car off a bridge into a pond. He survived the accident, but Kopechne drowned. Since then, many questions have been raised about Kennedy's actions that night. The incident continued to haunt him through his 47-year-long Senate career and derailed his plans to run for president. Now there's a new film called Chappaquiddick, which portrays the incident, and here's part of the trailer.
My family. There's no more important word. We share a lifetime bond.
We have a situation here on Chappaquiddick.
There's been an accident. We can't find Mary Jo.
What the hell happened last night?
I was driving.
Do you have any idea? Court of public opinion will have your head on a stake.
We tell the truth, or at least our version of it.
I want you to know that every effort possible was made to save her.
What do we do to help the senator?
A dead body holds a lot of secrets. Those can be the difference between guilt and innocence.
Are you saying that there's a possibility that maybe she didn't drown?
That's part of the trailer of the new film Chappaquiddick, starring Jason Clarke as Ted Kennedy and Kate Mara as Mary Jo Kopechne. Many in the conservative media have been touting the film. Fox News had several segments devoted to promoting the film. Here's a segment on Fox featuring host Shannon Beam interviewing former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee 3 weeks ago.
So why would Hollywood tackle the aura of Camelot after all this time? Let's bring in Fox News contributor and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. Governor, what do you make of this getting made? I mean, a lot of folks have said even if you tried to make this 10, 15 years ago, it wouldn't have happened. So why now?
I think a lot of it is that America now realizes that 50 years ago, there was an incredible tragedy in which someone got treated differently because of their last name, because of the wealth, the power, the influence, and the fact the media wanted to cover for the Kennedy family. I don't know that that would happen today, but there are still those moments in which people do get different treatment than somebody who doesn't have the last name, or all of the wealth, or the power, or the media cover. And it's really one of the reasons that a lot of Americans are just utterly frustrated with the institutions of power, because they don't believe that they play the same way for people of power as they do for just an ordinary person. Here's a simple question. What would have been the case had Mary Jo Kopechne been driving the car and Ted Kennedy was the one who suffocated in a pocket of air and suffered for hours? Because that's what happened. She didn't just drown. She was in a pocket of air, they later realized under the autopsy, and it was hours, and it was 10 hours later before Ted Kennedy ever told the police what happened. It's just a horrible tragedy. Reverse the role and ask yourself, do you think that they would have said to Mary Jo Kopechne, we're going to give you a probated sentence?
We're going to talk with a biographer and friend of Ted Kennedy's in just a moment, but that was a feature on Fox News just a few weeks ago featuring Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee touting the new film Chappaquiddick. A week after the accident, Senator Ted Kennedy went on television making a statement trying to explain his actions on that July night back in 1969. Here's his opening statement.
My fellow citizens, I have requested this opportunity to talk to the people of Massachusetts about the tragedy which happened last Friday evening. This morning I entered a plea of guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident. Prior to my appearance in court, it would have been proper for me to comment on these matters. But tonight I am free to tell you what happened and to say what it means to me. On the weekend of July 18th, I was on Martha's Vineyard Island, participating with my nephew, Joe Kennedy. As for 30 years, my family has participated in the annual Edgartown Sailing Regatta. Only reasons of health prevented my wife from accompanying me. On Chappaquiddick Island, off Martha's Vineyard, I attended on Friday evening, July 18th, a cookout I had encouraged and helped sponsor for a devoted group of Kennedy campaign secretaries. When I left the party around 11:15 p.m., I was accompanied by one of these girls, Miss Mary Jo Kopechne. Mary Jo was one of the most devoted members of the staff of Senator Robert Kennedy. She worked for him for 4 years and was broken up over his death. For this reason, and because she was such a gentle, kind, and idealistic person, all of us tried to help her feel that she still had a home with the Kennedy family. There is no truth whatever to the widely circulated suspicions of immoral conduct that have been leveled at my behavior and hers regarding that evening. There has never been a private relationship between us of any kind. I know of nothing in Mary Jo's conduct on that or any other occasion. And the same is true of the other girls at that party that would lend any substance to such ugly speculation about their character. Nor was I driving under the influence of liquor. Little over 1 mile away, the car that I was driving on an unlit road, went off a narrow bridge, which had no guardrails and was built on a left angle to the road. The car overturned in a deep pond and immediately filled with water. I remember thinking as the cold water rushed in around my head that I was for certain drowning. Then water entered my lungs and I actually felt the sensation of drowning. But somehow I struggled to the surface alive. I made immediate and repeated efforts to save Mary Jo by diving into the strong and murky current, but succeeded only in increasing my state of utter exhaustion and alarm. My conduct and conversations during the next several hours, to the extent that I can remember them, make no sense to me at all. Although my doctors informed me that I suffered a cerebral concussion as well as shock, I do not seek to escape responsibility for my actions by placing the blame either on the physical and emotional trauma brought on by the accident or on anyone else. I regard as indefensible the fact that I did not report the accident to the police immediately. Instead of looking directly for a telephone after lying exhausted in the grass for an undetermined time, I walked back to the cottage where the party was being held and requested the help of two friends, my cousin Joseph Gargan and Paul Markham, and directed them to return immediately to the scene with me. This was sometime after midnight. In order to undertake a new effort to dive down and locate Miss Kopechne, their strenuous efforts, undertaken at some risk to their own lives, also proved futile. All kinds of scrambled thoughts, all of them confused, some of them irrational, many of them which I cannot recall, and some of which I would not have seriously entertained under normal circumstances, went through my mind during this period. They were reflected in the various inexplicable, inconsistent, and inconclusive things I said and did, including such questions as whether the girl might still be alive somewhere out of that immediate area, whether some awful curse did actually hang over all the Kennedys, whether there was some justifiable reason for me to doubt what had happened and to delay my report, whether somehow the awful weight of this incredible incident might in some way pass from my shoulders. I was overcome, I'm frank to say, by a jumble of emotions, grief, fear, doubt, exhaustion, panic, confusion, and shock.
Ted Kennedy. On the morning of July 25th, 1969, a week after the accident at Chappaquiddick, really doing an on-air confession. And we're joined now by Burton Hirsch, who's an author who lives part-time in St. Petersburg. He's written several books about the Kennedys, including Edward Kennedy, An Intimate Biography, which came out in 2010. He's also a friend of Ted Kennedy's and was on Martha Vineyard's Island shortly after the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, and he joins us now. And Burton Hirsch, welcome back to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Oh, always good to be here.
So tell me a little bit about your friendship and your relationship with Ted Kennedy.
Well, I knew Kennedy pretty much in passing in college at Harvard. I was on and off the wrestling team, and he'd come in. I'd work him out sometimes. He was always interested in various kinds of sports. He was the regular end on the football team, a distinction none of his brothers managed, and to the delight of his father, of course. I found him a sympathetic personality, a little bit naive in certain ways. I mean, he had just begun to develop politically and intellectually, I think, at that time in his life. I remember I used to hold, one of my roommates would bring these jocks in once in a while, and I'd sort of tune them up for the government courses that they were taking, because I was taking some of the same courses, and I never thought much about it until I was in Europe for a number of years. I came back and I found out that Ted Kennedy was running for the Senate, and I thought, that's an interesting development. And it happened that the head of the government department, a man named Sam Beer, and I were friends, and we used to go skydiving together on the weekends. And one day while we were waiting for the wind to die down so we could have a jump, Beer turned to me and said, you know, I've been tutoring this guy, Edward Kennedy, because he's going to run for the Senate. He's got to overcome Eddie McCormick, who was a very powerful figure in Massachusetts politics, and he's got to do it in debate in order to have a shot at the senatorial nomination. And I said, really? I said, he must have come a long way since I knew him in college. He said, yeah, he really has. I think this may be the most politically astute of the Kennedy brothers, said Sam, who was in and out of the White House, who was very close to Jack Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And I took that into advisement. And the next time I was in New York, I was beginning to do features for Esquire magazine. And the editor at Esquire said, what would you like to write about? And I said, well, I've been told that Ted Kennedy is coming on fast and has a pretty good shot at a seat in the Senate, and maybe I should show up and see what's going on in
this
his office.
This is 1962?
Well, yeah, this is very soon after he became a senator. And I did, and he had a very talented staff, and he himself had developed enormously since I'd known him in school. And we began to talk, and before too long, I agreed to do a biography of Kennedy with a publisher. So I was, apart from the pieces, I did a series of pieces on Kennedy for Esquire, but I was a regular feature writer for them. This is sort of during the Tom Wolfe era. We're all aware of Tom Wolfe because he died the other day. And I knew all these people. I knew my generation, Mailer and the rest of them. And so I took on the commitment to put all this together at some point into a biography of Edward Kennedy. And in time, I wrote three biographies of Kennedy, one that came out in 72 or 73 called The Education of Edward Kennedy, and then one that came out. By the time I wrote the second, Kennedy was the dominant figure in the Senate. And it's called The Shadow President. He was resented by president after president because he simply took over the government from the Senate. And he had so much influence, and he was so persuasive to his colleagues that nothing could get, no legislation could pass without his imprimatur.
Would you say that he was, of the three brothers of Robert and John and Ted Kennedy, that he was the best politician?
Neither Jack Kennedy nor Robert Kennedy had careers of any real consequence in the Senate. You can't find a single bill that either of them with their name on it. Ted Kennedy had over 100 pieces of legislation with his name on it, and probably 1,000 that he wrote and worked and insisted on putting other people's name on, because he knew that he had to spread it around. He became the dominant personality in the Senate for almost 40 years.
Going back to July of 1969 and the Chappaquiddick incident, you were there. Tell us about how you happened to be there shortly after the accident.
Well, I was already committed to writing about Kennedy, potentially doing a book about Kennedy, and so I arrived within a matter of 24 hours after the incident occurred, and I checked into a motel in Edgartown, and began to sort of talk to everybody involved, because I knew this would be an important episode in Kennedy's life. Kennedy had been very badly hurt in a plane crash in 1964 and was somewhat crippled as a result. He was still using a cane at that point. And I knew most of the people at the party. The party was a kind of concession to the so-called boiler room girls, the young women who had worked to promote Bobby's overnight effort to get himself the Democratic nomination. And the Kennedys were grateful. The person who was sort of in charge of them was Joe Gargan, Teddy's cousin. And it was as a favor to Gargan and to the girls that Teddy came to the Lawrence Cottage on Chappaquiddick Island that night and hung around for a little while. He He says he'd been drinking. He, according to what he told me and what was determined later, he'd had two drinks, both rum and coke. And he was sailing in a regatta at that point, and he wanted to get back to his motel room, get some sleep before the second leg of the regatta the following day. So once the party kind of quieted down, there it was to him, it was very nostalgic. It was a lot of talk about Bobby, which was inevitably depressing to Ted.
Because the assassination had happened just a year before.
Yes, it had, and Ted had done everything he could to persuade Bob not to run. He said he didn't think he would win the nomination. He didn't want to see the family money dissipated to that extent, and it would have been if it had continued. And he told me, he said, I'll tell you the truth, Burton. I said, I think my brother's going to get his ass shot off. And Teddy had a deep fear, a suspicion that would happen. And when Bob sent him to tell Gene McCarthy that he was going to run, he got out to Wisconsin, hung around with McCarthy for 2 days, never mentioned the fact that Bobby had made this decision. As I know Bob was, I knew him too, and he was sort of wavering back and forth about whether to run against Johnson or not, and finally decided to do it. And Ted felt it was a great mistake. And Bobby had made a lot of enemies in the course of his period as Attorney General. I wrote a book called Bobby and J. Edgar on the relationship between Hoover and Kennedy. And the essence of that book is that the long, close association between Joe Kennedy, the founding father, and organized crime, which began during the bootlegging years, continued through their lives. And almost half the money that Jack Kennedy ran for president on came from the mob. So when Bobby became Attorney General and attempted to expiate the family's confused feelings about all that by putting a number of his father's business partners in jail, there was a certain amount of resentment.
Even before Bobby Kennedy was in the Senate, he was on a committee. Wasn't he on the Kefauver Committee looking at organized crime and going after figures like Carlos Marcello?
He was, the Rackets Committee.
Let me go back to Chappaquiddick for a moment. You arrived 24 hours after the incident. We heard Ted Kennedy's talk there. We also heard what Mike Huckabee said on Fox News. Did you see the film, the new film, Chappaquiddick?
I saw the film.
What do you think?
I read the screenplay before I saw the film. I thought it was a better film than I expected that it would be as a technical film. I thought the presentation of Teddy was unnerving in the sense that the actor caught his mannerisms, really did a good job. But I thought that the presentation of the incident was very badly flawed. First place, Teddy wasn't drunk. To him, a couple of drinks was nothing. He decided to take Mary Jo back to the ferry slip that night because his regular driver, Jack Crimmins, had too much to drink and passed out. Somebody had to, he wanted to leave the party. He was depressed at all this nostalgic mooning about Bobby, who he was unhappy enough at thinking about at that point. He had very complicated feelings about his brother. And he needed to leave, and he wanted to get back. And if you walk the road, you'll see that once you're away from the Lawrence Cottage, which is where the party was, the road takes a sharp left, but there's a dirt road, a wide dirt road that continues straight on. And that's what happened. Teddy must have been, as he did, it was a little unnerving at times. He would drive and he'd turn toward you and talk. And that must have happened. He missed the turn. He kept going up the dirt road. At the end of the dirt road was the dike bridge, which was cocked to one side, had no guardrails. He went right off the bridge into the water, into a surging tide.
No street lamps?
There was nothing there. Nothing, it was totally dark. It was just a local facility. There was no guardrails, nothing on the bridge. And then he got out. He attempted to save her. He kept diving. The idea that she would have been in an air bubble, which Governor Huckabee seems to have imagined, was preposterous. Kennedy himself got out the driver's side window, which was wide open, and there was a surging tide at the level at which Mary Jo was trapped, which was not that far below the surface, more than 4 or 5 feet below the surface, because the wheels of the car were still sticking out of the water when people first got there. By then, I missed that, but it would have, the surging tide would have filled the water very quickly, the car quickly. The idea that Mary Jo would have survived for hours or days or whatever in some kind of fantastic air bubble was a notion propagated by the diver. But in real terms, anybody that has seen the situation would know better, and the diver should have. You know, he pulled Mary Jo's body out.
We're talking with a personal friend of Ted Kennedy's. He is Burton Hirsch, who's an author who lives part-time in St. Petersburg. He's written several books about the Kennedys, including Edward Kennedy, an intimate biography. And we're talking about his experiences there at Chappaquiddick in light of the new film about the Chappaquiddick incident. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. I mean, I think in the film it shows, and I haven't seen it, but it shows Mary Jo Kopechne kind of mouthing the Hail Mary as she's just about to die in this air bubble in the back of the car.
That's sort of malicious invention. Nobody has any idea what happened in that car after Ted got out of it. He brought back his cousin and Markham, Paul Markham, who was U.S. attorney for Western Massachusetts. They both dived and they tried to pull the body out. They were unable to. Teddy having done the same thing himself immediately after the accident. So then the three of them walked to the ferry slip. They didn't steal a boat, which the movie would suggest. They didn't borrow a car. They walked back to the ferry slip, which wasn't that far away. And Ted swam across the cut between Chappaquiddick Island and Edgartown and almost drowned twice, he told me.
Why did he swim?
It was just, he was adrenalized to such an extent that he needed to do something. You must understand that the reason they probably didn't call the authorities right then, which is what they clearly should have done, as he himself certainly was well aware afterward, was that there was a tendency of the Kennedys, and this showed up again and again during various incidents, to take over a situation rather than call in authorities, to be their own, to create their own rescue apparatus. They didn't, this goes back, I suppose, to the sort of the Irish origins of the family. They didn't trust authority. They didn't trust the police. They were very skeptical about the large country, which they felt was nursing a lot of prejudices against them. I mean, I'll tell you, I heard this again and again from Bobby and from Ted. They don't like us because we're Irish. I'm Jewish. I never heard that kind of stuff very often. But for them, this was a constant awareness that they couldn't trust the prevailing authorities.
That goes back to the late 1800s and early 1900s in this country. No Irish need apply,
especially in Boston, which is where Joe Kennedy originated and where their fortune is made.
I still don't understand why Ted Kennedy didn't call the police. I mean, I understand what you're saying about fear of authority and all that, but what did he think was going to happen to Mary Jo? Why didn't he call a hospital or an ambulance?
Well, he should have, and he said so. You know, yeah. when he was tried, he was tried for leaving the scene, and he pleaded guilty and paid a huge fine and had a suspended sentence. He understood in retrospect what he should have done, but his impulse was what happened. I think was that he swam across. He almost drowned a couple of times. He got caught in an undertow. He staggered up onto the beach at Edgartown. He got to his motel room. He lay down in the bed and fell asleep. And when he woke up an hour later, he told me he wasn't sure whether the whole thing was a dream, a nightmare of some kind. So what he did was he called his then girlfriend, Helga Wagner, was an Austrian woman whom I talked to at one point. I got to talk to her because I could speak Tyrolese, and it helped, you know. And she told me that he was very confused. He didn't seem to have much reality sense. And the doctor, Watt, who saw him, showed me an X-ray of his brain. He had a hematoma, a large blood clot the size of a tomato sitting on his brain. So there, what he was.
He got that during the night of the accident.
When the car turned over, his head hit the bottom. You know, the car was upside down. The car sank immediately. His head hit very hard on the bottom of the cut, and he was. People, I talked to him weeks after the incident, and he was a little incoherent then. It took quite a while before he was fully himself, before he'd absorbed the brain damage that came as a result of the blow. And remember that he'd almost died in a plane crash in 64 and had spent a year in a hospital in a Stricker frame, being turned over like a side of beef every 12 hours. And he himself was not 100% physically. And then this accident occurred.
His back was severely injured in that plane crash.
His back was. He wore a back brace for the rest of his life.
Well, our phone number is 813-239-9663. In the film, it shows Joseph Kennedy, the father of the group of the Kennedy boys that we know, Jack, Ted, and Robert. He's had a stroke, but he's able to communicate, and I think the film implies that he orchestrates a cover-up.
Yeah, that's the implication. He supposedly had muttered alibi, and so forth. Joe Kennedy, by that time, Joe had a very, very bad stroke in 1961, just before Christmas, and he was a sad figure in bed clothes in a wheelchair for the rest of his life.
Did you see him?
I saw him once when he was taken by two of his sons to a Red Sox game. I happened to be sitting near him, and they brought him in, still in his nightshirt, basically, and seated him and sat beside him, and he attempted to pay attention to the game. But he was in no condition to orchestrate a cover-up. He had to be fed. He was in terrible, terrible, stroked out condition. To claim that he was, this Machiavellian mastermind behind, I don't know what they mean when they talk about a cover-up. What story could have been told about Edward Kennedy's performance that night that would have been any more disparaging than the truth, which Kennedy insisted that they tell as soon as the authorities were brought in the next morning?
Huckabee says in that Fox excerpt, and also the film suggests, that Kopechne remained alive for a long time after the accident.
Kopechne, as I said, I don't think that she could have, because the window, the main window of the car, the driver's side window, was wide open, and the car was upside down in a surging tide. How could any air bubble have been created in which she could have danced the hula and muttered her Hail Marys and swam out of the car, according to the original screenplay, then swam back into the car? All this is just invention by irresponsible screenwriters.
You're the only journalist that Ted Kennedy would talk to about the incident at Chappaquiddick. You wrote a long series for Esquire magazine in 1972, I believe.
Yeah, it was the whole magazine. Yeah. It was a whole issue of a magazine in 72.
What was revealed in that excerpt that people didn't know before, in that magazine?
Well, it was pretty much what I've been saying. I can't imagine a worse version of what happened than the one that Kennedy confessed to in court and afterwards and told me about and so forth. He felt terrible about it. He went and did everything he could to comfort the Kopechne family, whose main concern when they heard about the accident was that the senator not have been hurt, because they admired him very much, and they thought that it would be the end of his career. And the idea that, I knew Mary Jo Kopechne, she was an excellent person. She had a face you couldn't wait to forget. She was anything but the kind of showgirl that Ted Kennedy was drawn to. She had a terrible sunburn that day. She'd been watching the boat races that Kennedy was sailing in. And she wanted to get back and get some stuff on it and get some rest. He wanted to leave the party because he was uneasy with all this mooning about Bobby. So he thought it wasn't that far, and he thought he just he'd take her back. It was, there was no personal, as he said, there was no personal relationship between them.
After Bobby's death, did Ted want to run for president? Was that his ambition?
I think he always felt forced to run for president. I was in touch with him at one point when he ran for president. He ultimately did, and you know, in 79-80. Because he was pushed by the labor unions who were unhappy with Jimmy Carter as president.
At that time, he was an advocate of single-payer health care, too. I mean, he was
he was a proud
liberal, unlike his brothers. His brothers didn't like the term liberal, did they?
No, they didn't. Neither of them did. Jack particularly bristled when you said liberal. But Ted announced from the very beginning that he was a liberal, and he proved it. But when he ran for president... I think he ran because he felt pushed by the party. He felt that, that Carter was too far to the right, and that in the best interests of the country were not being served. One of the problems was that there wasn't much money to run on. I mean, the mob wasn't going to contribute to his campaign, that's for sure, any more than they would to Bobby's. So he was stuck, and he came out, I remember, very strongly against the Shah of Iran, who had come into this country, and Kennedy resented the police tactics in Iran at that time, and he talked him down a little bit. And that was unpopular because our defense establishment depended on Iran as a base in the Near East.
I remember that because Carter brought the Shah of Iran here. There was a lot of pomp and circumstance. This is before the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And people were wondering back then about the human rights record in Iran.
Yeah, it was terrible. Because they were so low on money, my wife and I in our old farmhouse put up his whole staff during the weeks before the New Hampshire primary, which was critical if you were going to break in and establish yourself by way of primaries. And then later on, when his speech wasn't working, he called me and I wrote him a speech that he then used throughout the rest of the campaign, and he never lost another primary. So later his aide told me that if he ever got to be president, he'd create a new department in the government for cultural affairs, and I'd be the first secretary. So I missed that gruesome opportunity.
We're talking with Burton Hirsch, who is an author, a personal friend of Ted Kennedy's. We're talking about the new film, Chappaquiddick. Burton's books include Edward Kennedy, an intimate biography, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. There are a lot of conspiracy theories about Chappaquiddick. There's what do you make of, and the film has some major historical facts wrong. What do you make of this effort to kind of rewrite history or to have these kind of sensationalized views of history?
Well, we're in an era of alternate facts, of invented truth, convenient invented truth, which this administration has dragged us into. And I think that not only from an epistemological, but from a human point of view, that nothing could be more unfortunate. We live in a culture which is science-based and reality-oriented. To invent what's useful and call that the truth is the high road to disaster. I spent many years studying and living in the remains of Nazi Germany. Hitler's fantasies resulted in thousands of Soviet tanks rolling into Germany and crushing the country, killing off a whole generation of young Germans. That's what happens when you don't establish reality and stick with it.
Hitler used lies in order to gain power.
It was his technique. And his first wife indicates that President Trump had a copy of Mein Kampf on his bed table and learned many lessons from it, it would appear.
Well, let's talk about that. You're living in Germany right after the war. You lived with a Nazi family, but there's something really important we need to know about that.
Well, just that what happened in Germany was a kind of freakish parliamentary move on the part of Chancellor Hindenburg. you know, to or President Lindbergh, who appointed somebody who appointed Hitler in an effort to eliminate the Nazi Party, which was losing ground very fast at the time Hitler came into power. Instead of that, Hitler took over the country by way of the cabinet, by way of Goering, and instituted a terror state. And Germans, after that, were living in fear of their lives. They knew that, that one mistake and they'd be in a concentration camp or a crematorium. It wasn't only the Jews. It was millions of people, Slavs and other Germans.
Labor leaders, communists, socialists.
Everybody that stood up and fought the Nazis wound up one way or another destroyed. So a lot of these people, like the family I lived with, the father was an ardent Catholic. He didn't want to join the party, but in order to keep his job, he had to. This is what can happen when you let fascism, when you let the most reactionary forces take over a society.
Burton, you were raised Jewish, and you were going over to Germany just after the war. What was that like?
Well, it was very interesting. I lived with a family. I was invited to join a Schlagverein, a dueling fraternity of aristocratic Germans. I made many friends. I concluded that a lot of the so-called anti-Semitism with which the Germans were claimed was pumped up to a certain extent. For example, historically, when the Nazis attempted to inflame the population on Kristallnacht in 1938, get them to break up the windows of Jewish storekeepers, they couldn't do it. They had to send brown shirts in mufti to do it. The German feeling, the Jews had a kind of ambivalent relationship to German society. And especially after the poverty and confusion of the Weimar Republic, they seemed to be doing better than most people. They were a sort of a commercial, property-owning, academic class. But there was not, from what I could tell, the rage to kill them all, which animated the members of the Nazi Party. That's the problem. A small number of people in a population can bring down policies like Nazism, and if the leadership promotes it, and we are in great danger at this time of seeing something like that happen in the United States.
And if the rest of the public's in fear,
that's right.
Of the leadership,
they may not agree, but they don't dare stand up to it.
I want to take some phone calls in a second. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. We're talking with Burton Hirsch, who's an author. He's written many books about the Kennedys, including a biography of Ted Kennedy. And he lives in St. Petersburg. We're talking about the film Chappaquiddick, but we're also talking about his relationship with the Kennedy family. And if you've got a question for our guest, you can call us up, 813-239-9663. Because we're getting down to the end of the show, I want to ask you quickly, next month is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. Did you know Bobby pretty well?
I knew him quite well socially, although I did interview him in his office in the Senate a couple of times. I climbed over Brumus, his Newfoundland, and talked to him. But mostly I would ski with him on weekends because a mutual friend of ours built a great ski resort in New Hampshire, and I would be summoned up to ski with Bobby, who was a pretty good skier, and the movie stars he showed up with are senators. They couldn't usually ski much, so I filled in.
What are your thoughts on the upcoming 50th anniversary of that assassination?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence that Bobby, like Jack Kennedy, was essentially killed by the mob. Although in the case of Jack Kennedy, there was some collaboration with elements of the CIA. If you're interested in how that really worked, take a look at my book, Bobby and J. Edgar. That'll tell you chapter and verse, because I talked to people, including people very close to organized crime in this country, as to how all that was planned and executed. But in the case of Bobby, I think that it was a typical mob hit. They set up Sirhan to show up and spatter the place with bullets. And then they also brought in a regular hitter in the crush who slipped. This is what the coroner suggested, who got a pistol in behind Bobby. And I think the person that bought and paid for that hit was Carlos Marcello, whom Bobby, when they were raising money for the Kennedy, for Jack Kennedy to run, they approached all the major mobsters, and one of them was Carlos Marcello, and he refused to contribute. So as soon as Bobby became president, he had Marcello picked up on the street and dropped off in the jungles of Guatemala. And Marcello somehow found his way back to society. And he later confessed when he was sent to prison to a FBI agent in his cell that he had paid the hitter that really killed Bobby, that caused the wound. That, I think, is the untold story of Robert Kennedy's death.
Did you ever talk to Ted Kennedy about his brother John's death? And did Ted ever reveal anything to you about what he thought about the assassination?
I never did, because it was simply too sensitive a subject. Kennedy would say things like, you know, I'm doing what I can, but I'm nothing compared to my more talented brothers. And I would say, Ted, you've done more in the decades in the Senate than either of your brothers accomplished. And he'd get angry at me. That's the one thing that he would get sore at me for. And so I stopped saying that. But the fact is that our history is hemstitched with moves that Teddy Kennedy made. Certainly our health bills are, you know, he's the guy that got apartheid ended in South Africa. He's the guy that prevented a face-off with Brezhnev on the missile crisis, the later missile crisis during the Reagan years. He stepped in and, in fact, replaced the president and took over when necessary throughout many decades. So it's just as well that he didn't get killed at Chappaquiddick.
We're going to take some phone calls. Let's go to Robert in Oldsmar. Robert, you're on with Burton Hirsch. And what's your question?
Yes. You know, my question, you know, listening to Ted Kennedy's, you know, so-called confession, now I just seen a lot. I just heard a lot of, you know, trying to paint the situation. I don't buy, I mean, I would think in a situation like that, you know, you would do the right thing, you know, and not worry about your career. But that seems to be what he was concerned about most. All the other stuff about, you know, whether they had affairs and all, you know, that's neither here or there. I mean, he was, you know, everybody's a flawed human being. But what I want to know is if these same set of circumstances happen today, say to Donald Trump would be the perfect example. What do you think the backlash would be for that? You know, and I really think, do you think politicians do as a whole get more preferential treatment than the normal person like you or I?
Well, I think it works both ways. They get more, the insiders allow them a certain amount more leeway. But when the truth comes out, as in the case of Stormy Daniels, for example, they get a lot more attention. You know, they get round after round of focus. And I think something that would be a passing incident in the life of, say, a major industrialist becomes the sore point of a political career.
Robert, thanks a lot for your comment. President Trump said at one point that he could shoot somebody on 7th Avenue and he would get away with it.
I wish he'd give it a try I don't think he could. And I think the country is gradually catching on to the extent to which our best values have been sold out by this administration.
Let's go to Joe in Port Richey. Joe, you're on with Burton Hirsch. What's your question?
Yeah, I endear myself greatly to John and Robert. I never was a fan of Ted. In fact, I had in-laws that lived in Hyannisport that used to tell me all the time when I would visit them that Ted would be pulled over by cops constantly for this or that. What does the author know about that?
I think that Kennedy was an indifferent driver. Often he was driven. Much of his time, people like Jack Crimmins, who was the driver the night of the Chappaquiddick incident, would take him to where he was going, as Crimmins did that night, especially since he didn't really know the roads on Chappaquiddick Island. The problem was not that Kennedy, you say, was a speeder or anything like that. It was that he was preoccupied with other things, and he would sometimes not pay as much attention to conditions on the road as he should. Although he had a good driving record, as far as I know, and never lost his license.
Yeah, but I wonder if we all did that. Everybody is preoccupied. I mean, especially today with cell phones, we would be having accidents all over the place. I mean, they were very torched by it, that he was getting pulled over for this and that. I'm not going to say, because I don't really know what he was being pulled over for, but to be pulled over constantly, it was something else.
Well, all I can tell you is that I was in and out of Kennedy's life for 40 years, and I never heard that he was being harassed by the police.
No, I didn't say he was harassed,
or that they were particularly concerned with his driving. I never if that was the case, it never came to my attention.
Mm. All right.
So, and he drove back and forth between his home in Virginia and his office every day by himself, and I never heard that there was any problem with that.
Really? Wow. All right, Joe, thanks a lot. Thanks for your comment.
Thank you.
All right, great to hear from you. And let's go to David in Palm Harbor. David, you're on the air with Burton Hirsch, the author of Edward Kennedy, An Intimate Biography.
Rob, thanks for taking the call. Mr. Hirsch, thank you. A couple of things, and this may seem quibbling, but I did want to take issue with Mr. Hirsch, your statement that Ted Kennedy ended apartheid. He did not. It was Mandela and the ANC that did that.
Well, I'd be glad to respond to that if you'd like.
Okay, and the other question I have is, given, and it's been a long time, and I haven't looked at it lately, but his initial comments and reaction about when that, you know, he was confronted, and his comments later on that we heard at the beginning just don't make sense to me. And so I'd like you to comment about that, and the fact that apparently this guy E. Howard Hunt was on the island at some time around that time.
Okay. All right, David, thanks a lot.
My understanding is that Hunt came much later in an effort to track down incriminating details about Edward Kennedy, not so much about Chappaquiddick, but about his general career at the behest of the Nixon administration. That didn't have anything to do. He wasn't there during the Chappaquiddick period, as I understand it. Now, this business of apartheid, Kennedy went to South Africa and slept on Reverend Tutu's floor and came back upset with the whole apartheid idea.
When did he go over?
Oh, this was during the Reagan years, I think. And he organized the Senate in such a way that he cut off all commercial contact with South Africa as long as apartheid was in force, and forced the white government of apartheid of South Africa to end apartheid. If you check my book, you'll see the details of that. But this was it was that embargo of South African goods and money that forced the apartheid government of South Africa to do it. Mandela was certainly the leader of the black community in South Africa, but it was Kennedy who put the screws to the white nationalist government in South Africa and changed history.
Yeah, I don't think we could dismiss, though, the heroism of the people on the ground in South Africa.
No, not at all. I'm not suggesting he was the only person, but it was his action that turned the corner and forced the government would have continued with apartheid indefinitely if they hadn't had to pay a price.
Yeah, I remember, because we used to do shows about boycotts of South Africa here in the 1970s and 80s, boycotting the Krugerrand. There were still coin companies here in Tampa, coin shops in Tampa and St. Pete that were selling the Krugerrand proudly. Sure. Burton Hirsch, I'm sorry we're out of time.
I enjoyed it.
But thank you for coming on. I understand that Fox News has done a long interview with you, and People Magazine has done a long interview with you.
Yeah, I was on Inside Edition not too long ago, too. Yeah. But again, you know, they pick and choose the stuff. And they asked me, do you think Mary Jo was in an air bubble? I said, the diver thought that was possible, but I don't think so. And what they ran was, the diver thought that was possible. So you got, you know, they cut the material in such a way that it undermines any effort to get the truth out.
All right. Well, Burton Hirsch, thanks a lot for coming by WMNF. Among his books, Edward Kennedy, An Intimate Biography. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up on the Midpoint program. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks a lot for listening. And thanks to Jeff Haynes. He's our phone producer today. We're going to get the latest news from National Public Radio right now, including the latest on what's going on with the U.S. and North Korea. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg.